Hookups and shakeups in the villa, Trump back on the campaign trail, a plague of pyrite, and plenty more on this edition of Playback Daily for Tuesday the 29th of June with me, Gemma Craddock. And we've got this.
And behind all the glitz and glam are human beings with the same frailties as the rest of us.
And this.
We didn't realise that we were buying a house that was actually eaten up in pyrite. It's like a cancer, actually, you know. I mean, you can't put a plaster over cancer and think it's going to go away.
And this.
In one day, like, we just wake up to find, like, we lost everything.
Everything.
Everything, exactly. Literally everything. He lost his industry. I lost the pharmacy. We lost the house.
And even a bit of this.
Inside his head is like a pre-Eurovision green room party or something. It's the oddest selection of tunes.
So let's get going. It's been a day with more lows than highs in the news. So let's kick things off with a good news story. One of the first Syrian refugees to have been resettled to Ireland has opened a pharmacy in Ballin in Carlow. Fadi El-Masri's new business has been up and running for a week, and he spoke to Ray Darcy in the afternoon.
It was a great week. Great achievement.
Yes, brilliant achievement. Absolutely brilliant achievement. But you always had your eye on the prize, didn't you? You always had this ambition to open your own pharmacy in Ireland.
That's what we said when you need to look to the future.
Yes.
You just need to have like something to look forward to it. So when we arrived to Ireland, we said like, yeah, if you need to start your life again where you've been before, you need to do your own business and help like the community in that. That's the most important things.
Yeah. So you're helping yourself and helping the community as well.
Definitely. Yeah.
Can I ask you a few questions about your life before you arrived in Ireland? So whereabouts in Syria are you from?
Originally, I'm from Homs, the third biggest city in Syria.
Okay. And you studied pharmacy, obviously, in college. Now, what did you do when you left college?
Yes, I studied pharmacy in Jordan, actually. Graduate from there, yeah.
Yeah. And then did you own your own pharmacy in Syria?
Yeah, I graduated in 2010. Then I back to Syria. When I opened the pharmacy just only for a few months before the war started in 2011. And everything is gone, not just only for me, for like millions. And for my family, like my father have like his own industry. He's a baker, his own industry bakery.
Yes.
And in one day, like we just wake up to find like we lost everything.
Everything.
Everything, exactly, literally everything. He lost his industry. I lost the pharmacy. We lost the house.
How do you get your head around that? How do you cope with that, Fadi?
You can't get, like, you just need to forget. You just need to look forward, because like if you keep thinking about the past and what happened, it's like very dramatic time, very bad time.
Yes.
Hard time for myself, for the family, for everyone leaving the war there. Maybe I left too early in the war. I left in 2011 when after like just only a few months, but my family stayed there or stuck there for 1 year in the situation where Homs was like destroyed. I couldn't brought them to Jordan. I back to Jordan at that stage.
Okay.
I left Homs and I back to Jordan where I studied to find any opportunity for work because I graduated from there.
Yes.
I stayed like 1 year just to prepare myself, save a little bit money because I left in my clothes when I left Syria. And
leave Syria? How did you leave Syria, Fadi? Was it in a car, on a bus, or did you walk?
I get a phone call to say like everything is gone, like I told you.
Yes.
And the situation was like, where is like airplanes bombing everywhere, like lots, but war, you know.
Yes.
Wartime. And I just like said to my family at that stage, like, we need to start moving around. I'll go back to Jordan while the border is still open.
Yeah.
And I'll try to do my best to brought you all to Jordan. So my family went from homes at that stage to Damascus, stayed with like a friend's house there, and I get like just only a bus at that stage. Like I said, like the board was opened, yeah. And because I studied in Jordan, so that was easily for me to go there. I worked there for like 1 year before I brought them. I went back there to my my college. That's the only place I know, and I back to my doctors. I told them. The one who studied me, who teach me on the college, like I backed for one of the doctors. I told him, look, what's in Syria? Maybe you don't see it now in the news, but you will see it in a few months. The situation in 1, 2, 3. I need help. I need work. I need to bring my family there. And a few of my lectures helped me in there to settle there for okay. work. And then after like few saving months, I brought my family to Jordan, and I was like very lucky in that, especially the border closed like just only 1 week after they arrived.
That was lucky. And then you decided to move yourself and your family.
I worked
to
there
Ireland.
For I worked there actually in like marketing things around like the pharmacy, in like pharmaceutical company there. I worked for like 3 years, just like to keep my family alive. Like I said, like it's very hard there to find work anyway. And till we get like be chosen from Ireland to travel at 2014, that was on December 2014. Yeah. I'll never forget that day. It's 9th, exactly 9th of December 2014.
What was it like landing in Ireland and stepping off the airplane?
Before the stepping off the airplane, when we get the airplane, I can remember when I said to my dad, like there, like I told him, is that really happened? Like, are we leaving? Do we have like another opportunity for life? Is that real? And he said, like, look, we was like at that stage 20 family leave all together. I am the only one who was like at that stage have a little bit English. Because of my studying the pharmacy, but I know that the people there was depending on me, like, you know, yes. to translate, to help them yes. in a few stuff. And when we arrived to Dublin airport, like, and the welcoming we get there from the United Nations, and here from the government there at the airport was like something unbelievable. Then we went to Mosny. I can't remember even like on the bus like journey during it's like just only 20 minutes from Dublin airport to Mosny, to Drogheda, yeah. Mosny. And I said, like, where am I? What's will going on? Like, it's you feel like that fear inside you, but you said, like, look, it is safe country. That's the most important things. Don't think anything else, like, you know.
Yeah. Is it that's the thing that people say over and over again? It's the fact that it's a safe country. It's there's peace here, and that's the big attraction, isn't it? It's hardly the weather.
The weather is gorgeous. Like, you can't say we're coming from 40 degrees. Yes, like, so we have like where we see the rain. Like, I can't remember, like, for the first few months. Oh my God, like, it's raining and not stop. But anyway,
yeah. So you were in Mosny for a few months, and you eventually arrived.
3 months exactly. Yeah, right. And then we moved to Bortleash.
Yeah, and you're a sort of, you have initiative. So you picked up the phone and you rang a local pharmacist in Bortleash.
No, just went there to the pharmacy. I get my CV in my hand, okay. because I don't have email still in Ireland. So I just like print CV with my neighbor there, and I get the CVs, and I start go around the pharmacy in Bortleash to tell them, look, actually that was exactly the second pharmacy I went in, and I told him, he's like more than a brother for me now, but I just say, like, my situation is 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't have like English to I don't have a lot of English to say it here, but I told him I need like to improve loads of stuff, and then I need to know about the pharmacy in Ireland, yeah. how is that will go on. And he just say, yes, yeah, come in. And that was like let's say like the start of everything.
And that was John Paul Shanahan.
That John Paul Shanahan in My Health Pharmacy in Bortleash, yeah.
And he's like a sort of a godfather to you now, an older brother.
He
sort
is,
of
yeah. Uncle. He's like more than brother for me. Yeah. Like he's like, since we're talking about 2015 on Marsh, and since that stage, like he support me in everything, all the information. And even when I open the pharmacy, I get like all the plans for him and I start asking him a few questions, like, you yes. know, and he never say no for me. He okay. never like just even like keep something for himself, you know, and he always like share all the things with me. Yeah.
And Bridget Dalton, tell us about Bridget as well, because she's working with you now in Ballon in County Carlow in the new pharmacy.
Yes. When I finished my training with John Ball, I start work around, and one of the places I ended in Bortleash was McAlwee Pharmacy. And that family, I just need to say here, it's great family. They that was the first official work. The training I did with John Ball was just only training for 7-8 months. And then I start working as a work. My first job, my first full-time job was with McAlwee Family in Bortleash. Yeah. I start with them as a technician and I end as a manager for one of the shop in Bortleash. That's because of the opportunity that Peter McAlwee gave it to me, where Bridget was like the pharmacist at that stage. In McAlwee's Pharmacy.
And she's working now with you. And your partner who you met in Jordan, went to college, she finally came over. You have a little child. So you're settling nicely into Ireland. Will you ever return to your home country of Syria?
I don't think so, unfortunately, to say that. But I don't think there is war will end in this planet. You know, I don't know. We hear about like what happened in Iraq and not finished till now, in Afghanistan and not finished till now. Since we grow up on those stories. And I don't think the situation in Syria, hopefully, please God, will change for the people who live there. But I think bigger than us, I don't think that will finish.
Pharmacist and business owner Fady El-Masri on The Ray D'Arcy Show. We'll take an abrupt swerve in another direction now for Barry Lennon's report on Today with Claire Byrne. Earlier in the month, Barry did a great piece when he spoke to families impacted by mica in their homes. And today he reported on the possibility of a larger scale redress scheme for people in other counties whose homes are affected by mica and pyrite. But how widespread is the issue?
I'm speaking to you this morning from Cusack Park in Ennis, where in normal times people from across Clare would come together to cheer on the banner. But people coming together for a different reason around here now, with more and more homeowners across the county saying their properties are cracking and crumbling away due to bad blocks. Pyrite has been identified or is suspected in homes from right up in Fanor across to Feakill, through Croisín here in Ennis, out west to Milltown Malbay and Kilkee, and also in Clonlough and Bunratty. 52 homeowners have come forward so far in Clare to say their homes are falling apart, but campaigners and public representatives insist this number could be just the tip of the iceberg, and they want access to the same redress scheme as those in Donegal and Mayo. Now, Danny Maloney built his home in Kilkishan in 1997, but soon after cracks started to appear. Settlement cracks at first, he thought, but now the property Danny shares with his wife, three kids and father-in-law is damaged to such an extent by pyrite he can no longer close his back door. He says 100% redress is needed for Clare homeowners as well.
We were in America for years. We earned money to build this here. We're paying a mortgage on this here. At the moment, the house isn't worth 2 cents. Look at the state of the cracks here. Look at me, all these blocks are falling away. Pint in there, look at that. See the way it's moving away from there? Now, if you come along the back of the house here, you can see our back door. Look at the state of all the cracks there. Look at all the press, all the paint is flaking away. We're living, a family living in this house like this. It's not right. This door here, this back door, look at it, right? We can't close that. Look, this is all pushed out. You can see it there. It says if we took the roof off, probably the whole place could just collapse.
Even along the bottom there, pieces of the house all falling away.
As I point there with the stick, see all along here? Moss here. We can't even heat the house with all these drafts coming in through. It's costing us a fortune. If you come around the side there again, you can see this gable. is a holy stake. Cracks all over it.
Vertical and horizontal cracks.
Everywhere. Getting worse. Well, I mean, we have this crack here that's widening and it's pushing on the roof as well. You can put this an inch thick. You can put that into your... An inch of concrete blocks falling out, pushing out.
Now you can slide that piece of wood
you
just
right in.
You can
slide that right into that crack there. How can anybody expect to do anything with a house or live in a place like that? Just the house is just crumbling away. Where do we go? Is somebody going to be responsible? Or are they just playing games with us?
Right at the corner of the house here, there's a huge gap as the wall comes away.
I hit a belt of a hammer, right? And all the blocks just fell away. You can see there on the ground. Look, see? Look, you can put your hand in there. No, that's not right. Where does it stop? Are the government going to do anything? Let us mollus rumble away for another 20 years and let the house fall down around us and somebody get hurt? Some family mollus member come out tomorrow and have to gable fall down. I don't feel safe, even with my kids. We're living in a property that's not worth a bag of taters.
Well, what's your message to the Housing Minister, Darragh O'Brien?
Well, my message now to Darragh O'Brien, if he is listening, they can get money to bail out the banks, but they can't get money to fix people's homes. I have a man inside there, my wife's father. He's 89 years of age, going on 90. Where's he going to go? Right? The man is blind. The man is on a wheelchair. We can't be living like this. We're living in a country that's bullying with money. They can find money for everything, but they can't find it for a problem that people are living in. The sooner that this 100% is got, the sooner everybody can get on with their lives.
That's Danny Maloney in Kilkishan. Another homeowner affected is Geraldine Kennedy in Parteen. After years of wondering why her home was coming apart, as she puts it, like a slice of cake, engineers finally confirmed the presence of pyrite last year and removed her crumbling chimney for fears it might fall on someone. So what was supposed to be Geraldine's dream home when she moved in 2001 has instead taken a severe toll on her.
This was the house that I wanted because of my grandchildren. You know, I wanted space for them to be able to play. We didn't realise that we were buying a house that was actually eaten up in pyrite. It's like a cancer, actually, you know. I mean, you can't put a plaster over cancer and think it's going to go away, because it's never going to go away. It's always going to be there until they get to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is the house has to be demolished. Upstairs, I have two bedrooms on the right-hand side of the house. The kids, my grandchildren, are not allowed up there. They don't sleep there. They'll have play days with Nana and Granda, but they have no more sleepovers, you know, because it's just too dangerous. I sit up most nights and I think and I listen to the cracking of the walls and I'm saying, oh my God, is it going to fall down tonight? Is it going to fall down tomorrow? You know, you don't feel safe. There's no safeness here anymore. You know, I mean, I feel more safer in my car.
10 grandchildren, they loved coming for sleepovers, and that really is tough for you because you loved having them here, but the worry was too much that something would happen to the house.
There's no way that I could actually bring them here, and anyway, I don't think their parents would feel comfortable with them sleeping here. A heavy goods lorry passes the front, it's on the main road, the house actually vibrates. And shortly after that, then you'll hear the cracking of the block. It's kind of like a munchy sound.
The stress of this, you've had health issues as a result when the problems became apparent.
Oh, I did, Barry. I got very, very ill. I lost my hair. My hair fell out from stress. I was hospitalised with a panic attack. My health deteriorated very, very bad.
Your husband is going to continue working, isn't he?
Yes.
Even though he's 65.
My husband continues to work. He's going to work until until he stops, really, because he has to keep going, because I'm still paying a mortgage on my house. Even though it's not a house that we can live in anymore, it's not a house that we can enjoy anymore. The severity of the problem in this house, Barry, you're speaking about major money.
Claire isn't part of the defective blocks remediation scheme at the moment. How worried are you that the clock is ticking here?
We don't know when this is going to come true for us, you know, so we have to get the word out there and get people to back us as much as we possibly can. Everyone is stressed and everyone is upset, you know, because your children are upset for you, but you're the strong one. You're the mother. You know, I can't go into a corner and shrivel up. I have to be the strong one. I have to fight, and I will fight. So Watch out, government, because we're here.
Geraldine Kennedy, very stressful in Partine. We know the working group, Mary, announced by the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, this day 2 weeks ago. Thousands of people on that day were protesting from Donegal and Mayo in Dublin. Now, that group's going to meet for the first time tomorrow, looking at changes to the current redress scheme. But what's next for those people in Clare?
Well, two local authority estates here in Clare are also being tested for the presence of pirate at the moment, but Clare County Council preparing an expert report for the Department of Housing to make the case for homeowners here to be included under the current scheme. As part of this, the council recently commissioned Mayo engineer Simon Beale to examine five properties in the county for the presence of pyrite. He delivered his findings to the affected homeowners within the past 24 hours. And Dr. Martina Cleary, who founded the Clare Pyrite Action Group, she's been bringing me up to date.
It was definitive, each house has pyrite, and it's the exact same manifestation and form of damage that's happening in Mayo.
Mayo, a significant majority of the houses require demolition. It looks like that's happening here as well.
Well, that's what the engineer has told us. And unfortunately, with pyrite, it's everything, complete demolition down to the foundation. To imagine your house being demolished, I can't even picture that yet. We're looking at 30 years. We know of a house from 1981. We know of a house from 2011. We're looking at three decades of defective materials being put into the market. And I think there are a lot of people out there that will be listening to this, and they probably know they have it, or they fear that they have it, and they're hoping there will be a grant, because it's very expensive from the very first day that you get your engineer out. That's an expense. I can understand people, you know, just wanting to hope, really hope, that they'll get some assistance.
What of the cost to the Exchequer? We've heard figures 1 billion euro, maybe 2.5 billion euro, a higher ceiling, and that just for Donegal and Mayo. Clare involved as well. The taxpayer is facing quite a substantial bill here.
I know at the end of every month how much tax I'm paying. I'm a taxpayer, and this perception that it's them and us. Actually, please give me back some of the taxes that I've been paying my whole life, that I'm paying this month, and continue to pay a huge mortgage. Like every single person in this group, and every single person impacted, is a taxpayer. So why can't I have my home fixed?
What are the next steps here, or the key dates?
So at the moment, we have the five core tests done, and they're being provided to the council. I know the council are compiling a report, and the last statement from the council was that this will be ready in the third quarter. Hopefully it'll be ready sooner. Hopefully the government won't put us through a prolonged period, or our council through a prolonged period. What I mean by that is that hopefully the department will recognise that, you know, we have one of the best engineers in the country. It's been proven that this is the same phenomenon as in Mayo. Hopefully they're not going to put our council and ourselves through months and months and months of further waiting. We should be in the scheme now. The evidence is there.
That's Dr. Martina Cleary from Clare. And it's not just Clare impacted alongside Donegal and Mayo, Barry. This is very likely to cause anxiety in government circles.
Housing Minister Dara O'Brien saying the cost to the Exchequer of repairing homes in Donegal and Mayo likely to top 1.5 billion. The Department of Housing previously said 2.5 billion. And while plans are afoot to impose levies on quarries and builders to help offset the rising costs to the Exchequer, there will be concern politically as more counties come forward. Clare, 170 properties in Sligo believed to be affected. Families in Tipperary and Limerick coming forward as well. Brother and sister Anne and Kieran Ryan built their homes outside Askeaton in 1990, but cracks began forming in 2010. They've spent thousands on remedial work and engineers' reports, but say the only option for them now is government redress. And Anne recently formed the Limerick Pyrite Action Group in the hope more people in the county will come forward to confirm their homes are impacted and allow the county access to the scheme. We spoke at Kieran's Gable Wall.
It started in 2010 or 11, and it started with small web cracks, and I thought it was plasterwork, bad plasterwork, you know, but it wasn't. It just started to get worse and worse and worse. And a year ago, there was nothing on the east gable, and now it's all cracked as well. So it's gone inside and outside.
What happens when it rains?
The water comes down the inside, and it falls down onto the window board and out on the floor. We have to put up a plastic drum there to collect the water, and we'll get heavy rain, you know. Put a power washer up against that, you know, to be gone into the kitchen in about 2 minutes. Is that it's just pure crumble, you know, mud.
Let's have a look at it over here. If you put your hand up to it, what happens?
Look. That shouldn't be happening.
It's crumbling away.
Crumbling away, yeah. That could all come down some night, like.
What sparked you to set up the Limerick Pyrite Action Group?
We weren't getting very far in finding out how many were in the Limerick area, so I decided bite the bullet and set up the Limerick Pyrite Action Group in the hope that we will get a better response and have a better idea. There has to be a lot more. And they're not actually admitting that they have it.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think some of them are a bit scared of the cost involved, of having blocks tested, of engineers' reports coming up with initially the money, which is quite a lot. No one intends to abuse the system. And you just want what you've paid all your life. All that work has gone into it and you have nothing at the end. After all of that, whether you had a 2-bedroom or a 10-bedroom, that's what you had and that's what you're entitled to. You don't want a Dallas Palace.
The appeal really is for people that might be affected here in Limerick to come forward, because at the moment Limerick not part of the defective block scheme and not entitled to any government support.
Yes, we need to assess the number of people here before anything can be done.
Limerick wasn't being mentioned at all.
There has to be a huge number of houses with that problem.
They are out there and just to try and get them, you know.
I think everyone thinks that their problem, they're the only one with a problem. Maybe after the protests in Donegal people are more aware now that it is practically a national problem. Also, the quarries should be made contribute as well. The taxpayer shouldn't have to pay it all, but the quarries should have to contribute.
Anne and Ciarán Ryan ending Barry Lenehan's report on Today with Claire Byrne. Now, I know I shouldn't poke the bear, but we're about to hit on the thorny issue of a government's reassessment of opening up indoor dining. And while there's been plenty of commentary all day long, Drive Time's John Cook was in Limerick to get the reaction on the ground.
As well as obvious disappointment and frustration, I'm finding lots of confusion among people in the hospitality sector as well. The Vintners Federation and the Licensed Vintners Association, as you mentioned there, say this plan is ridiculous and unworkable. They're questioning how they would staff this policy and hitting out at the government for introducing a type of measure it was previously against. And calling for clarity in the hospitality sector, they say there is overwhelming anger among publicans right across the country. Against that mood, I did find many people on the streets of Limerick City accepting the need for caution and a delayed reopening in the face of the Delta variant, including those I met outside Nancy Blake's pub, some enjoying a drink outdoors, others just passing by. And I asked them how they thought this vaccine pass idea would work at this and other pubs.
Oh, genius, sure, I don't know. Would he stop his local people going in? Like, I don't think he would. There'd be a bit of uproar over that with the local people. It's very hard to call the shots on it, like, isn't it?
I think the government is doing right. What's another 3 weeks delay? I mean, if you're just saying like it could be over 100,000 and 2,000 dead by August, September. So we went this far, let's keep going, do you know?
And do you think in a few weeks they could actually come up with a practical system whereby you or I could prove we were vaccinated to get into a restaurant or a pub?
Of course, yeah. Like a password on your phone. It's like a passport. Like things on your phone, yeah. Show it to your man, he scan it.
So you think they're doing right?
Yeah, I think they are. Look,
it could cause trouble at pubs, though. Can you imagine places where maybe you and your friends, maybe some are vaccinated, some are not?
Well, he'll have to sit out in the rain. I'll be sitting inside in the bar.
I have now with me a pass to prove that I've been vaccinated.
Well, soon that's going to be the only way that indoor dining, it would seem, can reopen here, right, as per today's announcement. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. And when does he expect to open it? Does he know yet?
No.
No. Well, I think it makes sense.
Are you sure?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though no one's going to ask you for the Northern Ireland County Down where you come from?
Yeah, but...
You'd be happy to be asked in Limerick.
But their vaccination programme is behind ours. That's the point. And if you wait and wait and wait till you get 100% of the people, sure, the businesses will be gone.
People are forgetting just how deadly this virus is. We've been stuck in for a long time. And I'm looking at the papers, they're blaming NPHET, they're blaming the government, they're blaming everything. Except the bloody virus is the one that's keeping us in, nothing else.
So you think it's right to be cautious and hold off longer?
You know, ask yourself the same questions I'm asking myself. If it saves one life, that life could be a member of your family that's just going to save it. So, yes, be cautious, be careful.
Hi, my name is Donal Mulcahy from Nancy Blake's, Denmark Street, Limerick. We're very upset that the regulations have changed again. We now have to go back to the drawing board. We now have to say to staff, look, we don't need you next week. It's just so confusing and frustrating, and how we move on at this stage, you know, so late in the summer.
The Vintners groups are saying this is a ridiculous and unworkable suggestion, that in a few weeks' time or whenever, because the date hasn't been specified, you'd be checking for who's vaccinated and who's not at the door as well. What do you think?
I think that'll be completely unworkable. We'll be asking people to show us your phones. Have you got your vaccine pass? Then we'll be asking people to show us your HSE, whether you had COVID or not, and if you had COVID, you're allowed in. And when will you be allowed in, or when will it stop? You know, at the moment they're saying if you have COVID, you're okay for 6 or 7 months. It's all confusing. Everything is confusing at the moment. Plus the fact that not giving us a date is so disrespectful to a lot of hardworking people who've been in this industry for a long, long time. That just says we don't care about the hospitality industry in Ireland at this stage. Europe is open, Ireland is semi-closed, you know. We're so lucky that the weather has been good for 3 weeks. If the weather had been bad for the last 3 weeks, this would not be on the table right now, because the whole country would be in uproar. It's not workable, and I personally don't want to introduce it into any of my establishments.
And that man is Donal Mulcahy in Nancy Blake's pub in Limerick. John, are there similar views among those in the hotel and restaurant trade?
Very much so. Similar sentiments being expressed by the Restaurants Association. Cormac reacting angrily to this latest plan on indoor dining only for the vaccinated, questioning whether this is workable, not to mind actually legal or democratic. I met Ronan Branigan, the managing director of the Savoy Collection. He runs two hotels and restaurants here in Limerick. And at the Savoy Hotel where we met, a small number of hotel guests this afternoon were allowed to eat indoors. It's a confusing situation for many, while others are still left outside on the street. Now, Ronan told me that government supports will need to continue now or be increased, because losing this trade in July is catastrophic to the industry. He said a good week in July is better than 5 weeks across January, February and March. And he fears the summer trade is now gone. Regarding the government announcement, he said it was really lacking in detail. But I asked him, could he enforce this new vaccine pass system, or whether he thought it would work?
The short answer is no. I don't see how we can or how we could. I certainly don't have the wherewithal or the knowledge or the expertise, nor do my staff, to even think about managing a system like that. The Fáilte Ireland guidelines, which come out for hospitality every time there is an announcement, are voluminous to start with. You know, adding more bureaucracy, or you know, checking, or you know, having to you know, split families, and you know, it just does not make sense. We don't know. Obviously, the briefing today was exactly that brief and lacking in detail. So we need that.
In a best case scenario, if the government can come up with some kind of a QR code scheme on you verifying who has a vaccine for July 19th or later this month, can summer be saved still?
I doubt it. Not from a hospitality point of view. You know, it is gone. You know, we plan for summers, you know, a year in advance. And obviously, you know, with foreign tourists and all of that, we know exactly who's coming and when. So, you know, we're going from week to week at the moment, not only from a business point of view, but also from an advice point of view, which isn't fair. We understand we're getting near the end game, and it is a race against the virus with the vaccine rollout. And we need that to continue. But at the same time, hospitality seems to be the you know, the easy option, just to close it down. People are still gathering in groups in houses and along streets. You know, that's still going on. So coming into a hospitality environment that is very controlled, where tables of six are the maximum, we're good at that. You know, and restaurants should be open, bars should be open, working on that basis.
You're the privileged few, the indoor diners here at the Savoy. Where are you visiting from, do you mind me asking?
We live in County Wicklow. We've been waiting for too long. I don't think the delay is a good thing, really. It's just, there's no need for this fear.
Well, they're saying it's a race between the vaccines and the variant now. They need to get more people vaccinated before it's safe to have everybody indoors again.
I think if you compare it to everywhere else in the world, we were leading and now we're well behind. I understand that restrictions are there for good reason and it's there for people's safety, but I don't know if delaying it further is helping anybody.
You're enjoying some outdoor dining here at the Savoy Hotel in Limerick, but would you like to get indoors?
I would like to get indoors. I was very disappointed today, because even though they said 2 weeks or something, you know, they can come along in 2 weeks' time and say another 2 weeks. I mean, that's what they've been doing so far, you know.
And so, it seems to be now it'll take as long as it takes to find a way of verifying that you're vaccinated, because those are the only people that'll be going indoors dining. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it'll be difficult to kind of control, to be honest.
Are you vaccinated?
No, no.
Okay. But your mum is?
Yes.
Okay, so Ronan might be telling you, well, sorry, you can come inside.
Yes.
But you can't, I mean...
Exactly, so how are we going to manage now? Like, we always go out together, you know? Mm-hmm. So... they'll have to stay out. Well, her husband is vaccinated now.
Okay, well, he's coming in with you so as well. I hope he's paying too. I hope he's got his wallet.
Yeah, he is.
What do you think?
It's a difficult one to get right. The people who are vaccinated are the ones who need it most. And the people who aren't vaccinated yet don't need it. There's less risk. But then when it comes to social aspects, everybody would like to be treated equally. And that's not necessarily the case at the moment.
Will it ever get back to normal? Because I really thought today was going to be the day where it was all ending, like, you know? So I just hope it doesn't get worse. I definitely don't think they made the right decision anyway.
Enjoy your meal, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Dolores Fitzgerald ending John Cook's report there on today's Drive Time. With so many people glued to the TV to watch the Euros, tumbleweeds now outnumber people on our deserted streets as another unmissable TV event launched last night. Whether it gives you the ick or you're going to crack on, as they say, it's the summer of Love Island. Never mind France's Icarian exit or Croatia's plucky fight back, the real drama is in the villa.
This is not a drill. Here they come. Meet this year's Islanders.
I'm Shannon.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Liberty.
My name's Hugo.
I'm Sharon.
I'm Brad.
I'm Faye.
I'm Jake.
I'm Chloe.
I'm Toby.
I'm Kaz.
On Morning Ireland, Justin McCarthy posed the question to Dr. Mary McGill, media studies researcher and journalist. Is Love Island a cultural phenomenon or just summer TV filler?
Could it be both? I think it might be. I was just thinking back on this last night when it kicked off to great fanfare as ever since 2015. But we're used to this at this stage because since the millennium, since the year 2000, when we had Big Brother, there has always been a reality television event of the summer. And of course, Big Brother is no longer with us. And, you know, it's interesting to note that Love Island initially ran for a series in 2005 and 2006 and kind of fizzled out. It was resurrected in 2015. So while Big Brother has fallen by the wayside, it has stepped in to fill this demand that there seems to be from summer audiences. And, you know, it follows a very, very similar trajectory. We get a bunch of young people who don't know each other, usually in their 20s. We lock them into a house. We fill that house full of cameras and audiences feast on it for a number of months. What's different, of course, with Love Island, and you mentioned it there, is, of course, this concept of finding love or you know, while you're at it, yes, getting yourself £50,000 in the process.
And instant fame as well, isn't it? Because
yes,
you're on television for 8 weeks if you're lucky enough to survive that long in the villa. And that means that you're instantly going to become a household name among a certain cohort.
Yes, indeed. I mean, what's interesting with the reality TV show format, and Love Island is you know, in evolution at the present, is the way that it relies on traditionally kind of ordinary people, plucking ordinary people and dropping them into the reality TV show format. But when they emerge from that format, they then find themselves celebrities, re-entering the world as celebrities. Now, of course, you know, people can be quite cynical about this. They can say, well, look, they're going into the situation knowing that this is the end product. And indeed, some of them want media careers. Some of them want to be famous. But with fame, with that level of visibility, and now you throw social media into the mix, it can bring all kinds of vulnerabilities. It can also bring, of course, you know, great fame and fortune. But with the likes of Love Island and reality TV in general, there's always another series coming. There's always going to be another set of contestants. So you get this hyper-visibility when you emerge from your reality TV show, but the actual system moves on quite quickly.
Yes,
so it's very tricky to navigate.
And some people are just not ready for what that brings, because there have been some quite serious psychological difficulties that some people have experienced having been associated with this type of fame, haven't there?
Yes, there have been. And there have been some very tragic cases, which are, you know, obviously very complex. There's with Love Island, of course, we had the tragic death of one of its presenters, Caroline Flack. And of, even, you know, as the show re-emerges, we're getting messages, we'll say, on social media from its Twitter account, you know, reminding people in relation to social media to be mindful of what they put out there. Now, reality television has always faced criticism for the kind of mill that it puts contestants through. And this year's Love Island, I suppose, has, you know, it seems to have taken this on board. We're told that there's duty of care protocols in place now. These involve therapy sessions, social media training, so how to deal with trolls, how to deal with this kind of pressure online, and psychological support before, during and after the show, which can't be a bad thing.
What does it say about us, the people who watch these programmes, Mary? Because I know we could all do with a break from reality at the moment. But, you know, is it that we want to be part of the social discourse, part of a big television event? Or is it that we enjoy watching people, beautiful people, break down in front of us and display their character flaws and their human frailties?
Well, indeed. Have we always been like this? Human history would suggest yes, to a certain degree. It's all of those things. And of course, social media has added a completely ever more intimate and accessible dimension to it as well. If you go back, to Big Brother, to the year 2000, you know, the newspapers came out, there was a new newspaper the next day. The news cycle moved on really, really quickly. If you wanted to go back and look at those stories, you'd have to go into an archive or keep the papers. Now we have social media, which gives everybody a voice, but there are severe downsides to that too. People sometimes expect things from these types of celebrities because they are supposedly more ordinary than other types of famous people. They expect to be accessible to them, they expect to be able to kind of talk about them, gossip about them and so on, and we don't often bring awareness that we're publishing. You know, this is for publishing, public consumption, in the same way that you would read an article, and it's out there and it's floating around and it's circulating. And behind all the glitz and glam are human beings with the same frailties as the rest of us.
Dr. Mary McGill, media studies researcher and journalist on Morning Ireland. And since we're on the topic of something, or in this case, someone, that elicits strong reactions at both ends of the spectrum, Mr. Marmite himself, Donald Trump, is back on the campaign trail and arrived on stage in Ohio at the weekend to a rousing soundtrack.
Do you know what? He is a macho man. It's true. And then his other, you know, the other songs came out. All the voices in your head. What? Inside his head is like a pre-Eurovision green room party or something. It's the oddest selection of tunes and things like that.
Joining Ryan Tuberty this morning was Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent with the Irish Times. And guess where she was on Saturday?
What is it like attending a Trump rally? I mean, you sit there probably for a few hours waiting for the thing to build up and you've got your pad and pen in hand. What are you looking at?
Yeah, those songs are bringing me back to Saturday, all those bopping tunes that we were all listening to for a few hours. So this was his kind of comeback rally, if you like, on Saturday. It was his first rally since he lost the election in November. And what happened is we were told it was supposed to start at 7 p.m., but media were encouraged to get there. We were told to get there by 3 p.m. And some earlier. So it was about an hour south of Cleveland in Ohio. So it was very rural, kind of in the middle of this, you know, very quiet area in the middle of the countryside. And I was in the biggest traffic jam of my life. There were hundreds, thousands of cars trying to all converge on this local county fairgrounds where the event was happening. So obviously all the people who were attending were also told to come at that time. So after being in a traffic jam for about 90 minutes and at one point abandoning the car, a guy started charging people $20 to leave their car outside his house. I finally got into the grounds. And exactly, you captured it there with the music. It feels like going to a concert. It feels like it's very upbeat. In this fairground, they had a kind of stage set up and they had a special stage for the media. We had our own kind of pen that you walk yeah. into. And then around the grounds, where they're selling pizza, selling ice cream. It was really, really hot. And people probably know we're having a real hot spell here at the moment. But people seemed happy to be there for hours, you know, in advance. And then the music was playing, all these different hits for hours. And then around 5 o'clock, half five, we kind of had the warm-up act. So it started with a prayer, a local minister saying a prayer, and then the Pledge of Allegiance. And then we had different kind of local politicians and other people on the stage. And then finally, Trump, he was an hour late, he started speaking at about 8 o'clock.
Does he still walk onto that music, that particular song that he's brought back to life? That because I remember watching all the various rallies and so on, and there was this song about America and God bless the United the USA.
America, yes, that's the one. I could sing it now, but it's a bit early in the morning for me. But yeah,
never too
God
early.
God bless the USA.
That's the one. God bless the USA, which is kind of this like country western Bible belty sort of kind of 50s throwback. God bless America.
Yes, really patriotic, and it's very popular down the south. It's got like a country twang. That's what he comes on to now. He didn't play YMCA. People might remember last year, he started doing this little dance at the end of his rally.
Yes.
Where he was kind of pumping the air. So there was no YMCA at all played. So I don't know if, you know, there's copyright issues there. But we didn't hear that song. Lots of Elton John as well.
Right.
So I don't know if Elton is happy with this, but lots of Elton John songs. And of course, Trump famously wants to send Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, a CD of Rocket Man. Back when he was negotiating with them. And John Bolton said that in his book, actually, his former aide. So he's obviously an Elton fan too.
When Donald Trump comes on the stage, I've never seen the man in the flesh, when he comes on the stage to a rally like that, is he very, very magnetic? I mean, the sense that is your eye drawn to him? Are you impressed by him? Is he charismatic? Or are you looking at his skin, his hair? I mean, where are you coming from with it all as a journo?
Yeah, like generally he is charismatic. I compare him to, I went to see Donald Trump Jr., his son, just before the election, also in Ohio, actually. And I was struck by the fact that his son, you know, didn't have the magnetism of his father, didn't have those communication skills. Whatever you think about Donald Trump, he can communicate. So yes, he's a performer. And, you know, he thrives with adulation and cameras. That's what he likes. That's where he wants to be. Now, it was a huge, it wasn't as big as maybe Croke Park, but there was a sense that, you know, everybody was standing quite a bit back. At one point, there were big, two huge screens either side of him under the name, under the word Save America. And at one point, the crowd got a little aggro because they said that the screens weren't working, but they got that sorted and then people were happy. So it was hard, you know, lots of people were far back from him. But he was kind of doing his usual kind of prowling around the stage. Mm-hmm. You know, when he walked on, he was clapping, punching the air for quite a while to this America the Beautiful song before he actually started speaking. Then when he started, some of it felt a little bit, and I was chatting to other journalists who were there, a little bit, you know, he's just regurgitating the same gracious hits. And what was he really into it? What, you know, was his heart into it? So it was like being back in the old days, he was talking about the wall and immigration and a lot about how what he had done. He was kind of this aggrieved person saying, but I did this and I took you out of the Iran deal and I did this, kind of seeking validation, if you like. And some of it got quite, you know, boring. He was speaking for 90 minutes in the end. But then he was speaking from a teleprompter, but then he'd come back and he'd, you know, ask these rhetorical questions to the crowd and they'd all cheer. So you could see that this is a man who loves that, who thrives on it. And the crowd really, I mean, they were quiet, they were engaged, they were extremely patient. They'd been there for absolutely hours. And they loved him. That was the thing. He performed for them and they were very, very happy with what they were getting for that.
And among the things they were getting were...
We won the election twice. And it's possible we'll have to win it a third time. It's possible. And we so-called lost, but we didn't lose. We didn't lose.
I mean, this is the revenge tour. This is personal. Mm-hmm. He's going around trying to pick off the people, the Republicans who voted against him vis-a-vis the impeachment. And within that argument then is a throw forward yet again to 2024. So there's kind of two-pronged approach here in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about this rally was that he was also introducing a local politician who's running next year in the midterm elections. And what Trump has done, and he's doing this around the country, is that he's endorsing candidates, maybe new candidates, who are running against people who voted to impeach him. So he's going around the country picking out these people. So this guy was a local guy called Max Miller, who used to work for Trump. He's running in Ohio. So he brought Max Miller to the stage. And then Trump went on a rant about the incumbent, the guy who's currently representing Congress in Ohio, who voted against Trump in the impeachment. And he was saying he was saying that this man was a sellout and a disgrace to Ohio, and this is why he was supporting this other candidate. And during the speech, he also hit out on people like Liz Cheney. She's one of the top Republicans in Congress here, the daughter of Dick Cheney, who used to be the vice president. And she has become a real anti-Trump person. And Trump is basically, as you said, that's the word, revenge. He is taking a revenge on her. We expect him at some point to go to Wyoming, her home state. I actually met someone in the airport, a Trump supporter from Alabama, who's a fundraiser, and he was telling us that their next stop, they plan to go to Wyoming to basically take out Liz Cheney politically, to go and endorse someone else to run against her next year.
And of course, so her dad is a person of interest too.
Yeah, people may remember him with the Iraq War. He was the vice president under George W. Bush. And he was really seen as the architect of the Iraq War. So it's not Liz Cheney and her father are, you know, Republican royalty. They are conservatives. They are the real deal with the Republican Party. And even if she is turning against Donald Trump, this was a real worry for him. But she has now cast herself as kind of the traditional Republican. And then the other half of the party are still under thrall to Trump. And that's what's so interesting now, is where is this all going to fall? You know, how far can Trump keep this power over the party? Because he does have it. At the moment, he's the de facto leader of the Republican Party. There's no one else really challenging him for that. We don't know who's going to run yet in 2024. Is there another name going to come up that's really going to start leading the party? But it's definitely the case that Trump is continuing to exert that hold over the Republican Party and over those supporters.
Do you know what's really sad about all of this as well, in the middle of it, is, do you remember, we were talking about it yesterday, about how after 9/11 and pre-9/11, I'm going back in time a bit, Suzanne, but pre-9/11, back to when he cleaned up New York so impressively, Rudy Giuliani. And you look at him now wandering around, you know, I know the hair dye dribbling down the face was unfortunate, but that's just, I kind of summed him up in terms of, it was like a metaphor of sorts. And you're thinking, he was considered to be quite brilliant and potential White House material. And how did he become so pathetic and a liar and, you know, just the opposite of all the goodness that he seemed to project only 20 years ago?
I know. And just last week, his law license was suspended by New York. And it really epitomized that kind of fall from grace for Giuliani. And himself and Trump, I mean, they know each other years on and off because they were both, you know, men around town in New York.
Yeah.
But Trump has kind of remained loyal to Giuliani. He's fallen out with a lot of people, but he's remained loyal. And actually last week he put out a statement criticizing this news that Giuliani was losing his law license. Actually, Giuliani's son, he's one to watch, Andrew Giuliani.
Oh.
And he's been spotted down in Mar-a-Lago in Florida with Trump. So he now is saying he's going to run for governor of New York. So now he's not seen as, I mean, he's going to run as a Republican. And the mayor of New York is election at the end of this year, but the governor is what he's going for. So he obviously thinks he's, you know, got a political career ahead of him. So I think he's kind of one to watch with the old Giuliani legacy.
Fascinating. And the whole Cuomo Farrago there is another for another day. But always an interesting office in public life in America, the governorship of New York. Just while I have you, as we're shooting the breeze, I was watching, I don't know if you'd be listening to a podcast, but Slow Burn is a particularly good one. And there's another Dimbleby one, The Fault Line, both of which are focusing on the Iraq War. And I can't help but notice that the journalists who seem to be working on those would have been almost too young to be, I suppose, cognizant of what was happening at the time of the Iraq War. And in the reassessment, or the assessment, if you like, of what happened then, George W. Bush was starting to become almost cuddly after Trump arrived in, and even Obama. There was kind of this nostalgia. But these programs seem to be putting a lie to that, saying, well, hang on a second, all that mission accomplished, all that bad decision making, all there were no weapons there, all this kind of... Is there a broader sense of reassessment of Iraq in America at the moment, or is that just us Europeans listening to podcasts?
Well, it is. And you're right about George W. Bush. It's so interesting how we can view him differently in light of Trump. He seems like, to many people, like an angel now compared to Trump. But yeah, the reality is he presided over that war. You were right. That's kind of in the ether at the moment. And one of the reasons is that we're coming up to the 20th anniversary of 9/11 in September. So that's obviously going to be a huge moment in this country. And the other part of that is, and I think this is one of these stories that's so important that kind of isn't getting enough coverage. Biden announced in April he was bringing the remaining troops out of Afghanistan. Mm. So the troops have been in Afghanistan maybe 19 years, 20 years nearly. And he, it's kind of controversial because what's actually happened to the vote today in Congress on it, there's a lot of members of Congress who are really worried that a lot of Afghans who helped Americans, maybe worked as translators or drivers, that they're going to be in serious danger when the Americans move out.
Sure.
And they're trying to fast-track visas for them to get to America. The Taliban is on the ascendant again. The Taliban is kind of taking over bits of Afghanistan. Now the Americans are moving out. The Afghan government is very weak itself. So there's a real, it's a real perfect storm. And yeah, it's really worrying, I think, what's happening there and how this American pullout is going to happen. Because you're right, I think people, most Americans want out of Afghanistan. You know, they want to turn the chapter on Iraq and Afghanistan that whole time. But they're not, polls are showing, they're not that engaged. They're not thinking about it all the time. You know, they're not that engaged. So it's going to be interesting for Biden. He made this decision that was controversial to take out the remaining troops. There's not that many of them left. And, you know, are they kind of leaving the Afghans, abandoning them at this crucial point? So I think that's going to be interesting, and it's going to actually be a big part of Biden's legacy ultimately when we stand back from this. But look, I think expect a lot of retrospective analysis of Iraq, of Afghanistan around September, because it's going to be a very, very big moment here with the 20th anniversary.
Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent with the Irish Times on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And a little and finally story courtesy of Ray Darcy.
There's big drama going on in the toaster world. Yes, yeah. It's sort of one of those small little irritations. And it wouldn't have happened if we didn't have a lockdown. And there wasn't this obsession with sourdough. And I know I was there at the start. I apologise. Anyway, seemingly hipsters are outraged as modern toasters are too small for their focaccia and sourdough loaves. The average, which have done a study on this, so the average toaster, 14.5 centimetres wide by 12.8 centimetres high, and allow for varying bread thickness, but they don't facilitate your average sourdough slice, which is 22 centimetres wide. Could you not cut the feckin' thing? Cut it in half! Isn't that how you do it? The other thing I've noticed about toasters is that certain bread types, despite the thickness, and on the same setting, they toast differently. It's probably something to do with the chemical makeup of the dough in the bread. And I'm wondering, is there a thing out there called a smart toaster? Some sort of toaster that would take your slice of bread, do some sort of scientific analysis of it, and then you could say, I want it light brown, and it would do all that for you. Do all the computational stuff, the scientific stuff. You know, if there's a certain type of flour, if there's gluten or no gluten, if there's blah, 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 that they do all that. And then maybe it might be something that would suit the people with their sourdoughs and their focaccias as well, that it could, the slots could change.
What kind of animal toasts focaccia? Anyway, no smart toasters, but plenty of smart-ass toasters.
Yes, there is a smart toaster, Ray. It's called Under the Grill, the one we were all brought up with, the one that toasted turnover, batch loaf, and if you remember, the milk pan. And what's wrong with using the grill and the cooker? I use that for toasting the heel of the batch, and you can control the colour of your toast. Delicious, says Eileen of Dublin. Well, Eileen and Terence, I'll take your grill and I'll raise you a fork and an open fire. A toast and fork. Remember those? The extendable toast and fork. And you get that lovely smoky taste from the bread.
I see you, your toasting fork, and I raise you molten magma at the formation of the continents. Or something. And on that note, I think it's time for me to stop. Thanks for listening.